This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you, Fabio. Thank you, Stefania. Thank you, everybody, for this invitation. And I'm particularly pleased to not only be able to introduce this, what will be a really rich sequence of events for these 2 days, but also to do so at a, I think, really one of the most exciting institutions, one of the institutions that's setting the pace in contemporary cultural conversations and art practice. I think Marinetti would have been pleased to see the centenary take place in an institution like this and not in a museum or an academy. What I'm going to present today is really very much a thought experiment that brings together two longstanding interests. One is a project that it's the slowest book project I've ever worked on, of course, whose theme is speed. And a reflection on what I think is sometimes an undervalued part of the larger futurist enterprise. My title is derived from the 1916 Manifesto, which I'm going to be anchoring my remarks in. And as you can see, it's divided into six sections, which will take us from quickening to Godspeed. I wanted, last but not least, as a prefatory remark, to underscore the fact that the centenary really does begin as we speak, in the sense that the automobile accident that's described in the Founding Manifesto of Futurism actually took place in the month of November 1908, not in 1909. So we're not really anticipating the centenary. The true beginning of the centenary is the auto accident of 1909. Why speed is a religion morality? Movement equals life. The equation appears so self-evident that it shapes elementary human beliefs regarding the distinction between the animate and the inanimate, the ephemeral and the enduring. It founds the edifice of the natural and human sciences, going back to their ancient beginnings. It provides the basis for the attribution of thonic, meteorological, and cosmological motions to the actions of higher beings in religions primitive to modern. The logical corollary to movement equals life is the equation that shapes what I will be referring to here as the anthropology of speed. More movement equals more life. The more in question may be qualitative or quantitative, momentary or lasting, mental or physical. Its expressions vary from epoch to epoch, from culture to culture. Without exception, however, these additions to the human assume the form of myths of transformation, whose contours are summed up by the 7 centuries worth of meanings accrued by the English verb to quicken. To quicken is not just to accelerate, but also to animate, to give life. Either that life which becomes evident when in the course of a pregnancy a fetus first begins to move, or the higher life associated with spiritual pursuits. To quicken also means to stir up, to rouse, or to excite, both physically and mentally, in ways that converge with secondary meanings that link quickening with the leavening effects of yeast, the kindling of fires, and the production of drugs. All these life-giving, rousing, counter-gravitational, incendiary, narcotic meanings are held together by a shared association of quickening with light that dazzles. The keener lightnings that quicken, for instance, of Pope's Rape of the Lock. So quickening in this expanded sense helps to explain why the speed of the Spartan sprinter Latus in the 6th century BC is impossible to describe. Impossible because, so the Palatine anthology tells us, pounding the soil and soaring above the stadium at the very same time, his speed was less human than demonic. Daimonion is the word that's employed. Likewise, it helps to understand how 19 centuries later, and 9 heavens above the terrestrial sphere, an ecstatic vision of ever faster concentric angelic rotations precipitates Dante's own metamorphosis into a wheel spinning with the infinite velocity of a divinity who is the drive mechanism of the universe. Another 600 years later, it informs Thomas de Quincey's seminal account of how he was transformed into the protagonist of the Confessions of an Opium Eater by means of an experience of the glory of motion atop a speeding mail coach, an experience whose effect is encapsulated by the Latin phrase magna vivimus, we live bigger. Yet another half century forward, it shapes the Hendecalogue of Futurism's founding manifesto with its claim that time and space died yesterday, and we already inhabit the absolute because we have created eternal omnipresent speed. Adverging on the present, it animates the dreams of the cybernetic imagination with its fusion of post-humans and thinking machines, outpacers of the human from Asimov's 2001 to William Gibson's Snow Crash. Human existence is defined by a set of natural paces and rhythms, paces of walking, talking, breathing, and thought, and sensory perception, cycles of wakefulness and sleep, activity and inactivity. Enabled and constrained by the capabilities of the human body, these spatiotemporal, perceptual, and communicational rhythms are embedded in turn within those of the natural world, day and night, seasonal flux, growth and decay, birth and death. When the relationship between the two is altered, the human as a category is pressed outwards towards its boundaries with other orders of creatures, with more than natural forms of being and bodily expression, with alternate modes of cognition, consciousness, or intellection. These boundary lines are themselves movable markers whose location shifts as a function of the everyday rhythms that characterize a given culture conditioned by social conventions and technological possibilities. So whether mental or somatic, accelerations of the human pace with respect to that of the natural world give rise to the two intertwined narratives of transformation upon which hinges the Marinettian text that will be the main object of these reflections, the May 11, 1916 manifesto entitled La Nuova Religione Morale della Velocità, The New Religion Morality of Speed. Now, I'll return later on to the question of what exactly a religion morality might be, and or why and in what sense speed is modernity's religion morality. But suffice it to say that the first of these narratives of transformation thinks the effect of speed in terms of what I would describe as strong transcendence. Strong because the transformation envisaged is irreversible. Here the crash, the fall, and the accident are the exception rather than the rule. Transcendence, because acceleration prompts a leap from the human to the more than human within a setting, the setting of a universe in which speed is one of the defining attributes of the divine. Gods figure as speedster charioteers like Apollo or Surya, fleet-footed messengers like Hermes, racing winds, saints, or angels, so swift in mind and body that they are able to minister to the needs of a vast flock of mortals. Now, strong transcendence, of course, figures among the traditional promises of religious practice. It imagines velocity as an engine of deification. The human subject of speed steps outside of time into an idealized realm of frictionless motion, achieving near instantaneity of motion, whether bodily or mental, or more typically both. My second narrative of transformation is closely intertwined with the first. It thinks the effects of speed in terms of what I will call weak transcendence. Weak because the adrenaline highs, frenzies, thrills, states of exuberance, and sensory saturation accompanied by perceptions of space-time compression that are its defining features are momentary and reversible. The crash, the fall, the accident become necessary features of an inevitable reentry. I keep the word transcendence, however, because however momentary and reversible, these episodes of transport from the human to the more than human retain their association with stronger logics of transformation, such as deification and metamorphosis, but with a difference. Rather than vanishing, the fleshly body becomes acutely present in weak forms of transcendence. Friction triumphs along with bodily expenditure, resistance, muscular and/or mental effort. Instead of promising to deliver humanity from temporality, the resulting altered states drives the human subject of speed inside of time, that is, into an intensified, rarefied experience of time-space compression that, like two lines meeting in infinity, verges on experiences of the supratemporal or supraspatial, even as it fails to deliver them. Weak transcendence plays off of Bergson's concept of durée, whose metaphysical underpinnings are further confirmed by the close ties that bind weak models of transcendence to their stronger counterparts. But whereas the latter are by their nature stable idealizations, the former are inherently unstable and built around paradoxes, tensions, and conflicts. Their fundamental reversibility exposes them to logics of addiction, inspiration, and the bipolar. Weak transcendence prevails over strong transcendence in the industrial and post-industrial eras. Now, in both of these narratives, the word transcendence obviously refers to a multiplicity of outcomes, from deification to levitation to overcomings of the body's fleshly fragility to forms of self-multiplication involving ubiquity, all familiar futurist themes, to illusions of expanded bodily contours, to states of visionary transport or frenzied mental activity, or even just acute embodiment. And I think this heterogeneity is unavoidable, whether we are dealing with the soma-crazed charioteers of the Rig Veda or with avant-gardists drunk on automobility. It is simply the heterogeneity of limit experiences themselves, whether framed within the bounds of traditional religious belief systems or their secular descendants. So whether in Marinetti's 1909 manifesto or in the 1916 elaboration of A Religion Morality for Modern Times, or in the vast array of futurist experiments carried out during the fascist decades, speed's triumph is paradoxical. And it's paradoxical by design. On the one hand, speed figures as a new beginning, as the wedge that disjoins the modern era from all that preceded it. It is essential to all of the leitmotifs of the founding manifesto: aggressive movement, feverish insomnia, the race pace, the mortal leap, and so forth. It gives birth to a new kind of beauty built upon the love of danger, the habit of energy and fearlessness, which is to say a kind of risk-based model of aesthetics. Speed cuts across all orders of society, bringing together the masters of the era of industry, imagined as the drivers seated behind the cosmic kind of global terrestrial steering wheel, with poets charged with the task of augmenting the enthusiastic frenzy of primordial elements, as the manifesto puts it, to even workers agitated by labor, pleasure, and revolt. In short, speed inaugurates a new cognitive regime and a new social order, altering everything from forms of pleasure and play, including aesthetic play, to the everyday practical realities of life. On the other hand, speed arrives at the end of a lineage at least as ancient as the human imagination, and the founding manifesto is forthright as regards this ancient pedigree. In the name of an overcoming of all mythology, it repeatedly invokes classical and Christian myths. We are about to witness the birth of the centaur, and soon the first angels will fly, Marinetti prophesies, of course alluding to the body-machine functions of driver and car and pilot and airplane. The formula is reprised at one of the text's culminating moments, a race car with its hood adorned with great pipes, like serpents with an explosive breath, is more beautiful than the victory of Samothrace. Now, the provocation is multi-layered. Yes, the Nike referred to was indeed a fractured object of passéist worship, ornamenting the main stairwell of the Louvre. And yes, museums are destined for demolition, like other institutions of memory, as such other institutions as libraries and academies. Yet this Nike was also selected as an object of comparison because she is the race car's enemy twin. She's a celestial charioteer descending from the skies to grace the conquering Thracian fleet, associated with Kratos, strength, bios, abia, force, and zelos, rivalry. In other words, the embodiment of eternal omnipresent speed as it was understood in the pre-industrial era. Far from inadvertent, The assault on the logic of comparison is of a piece with the assault on passéism. Futurism is born out of a desire to pit modernity against antiquity in a conflict no less fierce than the battles it promotes between genders, generations, nations, cultural political isms, or between humans and machines. Its strategy is a strategy of perpetual tension, maximized by ensuring the parity of rivals and a continual raising of the stakes. Omitted from the strife are weak opponents or mere predecessors or successors to the strong. So while classical antiquity is hyper-present, the readings on Marinetti's nightstand are not. Given his Francophilic upbringing in Alexandria, Egypt, it's conceivable that he was unaware of De Quincey's celebration of speed as a hallucinogen in the English mail coach, or of Dickens' phantasmagoric descriptions of train travel, or even of Walt Whitman's ruminations on what it's like to wake up in a sleeper car in Specimen Days. But we know that he had read the very best of French railway and motoring literature, including recent works such as Maurice Maeterlinck's In an Automobile, Octave Mirbeau's La 628, and Marcel Proust's Motoring Days. And then there is the special case of Mario Morasso, theorist of egoarchy and artistic imperialism, a contributor to Marinetti's own review, Poesia, a fellow ultranationalist and anti-parliamentarian, from whose 1905 volume, La Nuova Arma, La Macchina, Marinetti derived the Nikkei race car juxtaposition. The winged, headless victory of Samothrace enthroned in the stairwell of the Louvre, whose robe encases the wind and whose posture reveals the impetus of a smooth and joyous race, can be compared, and this comparison shows no disrespect, with the iron beast shuddering and pawing the ground, with the engine's excited pulse, and thereby offering its own magnificent display of virtual force and making palpable the mad velocity of which it is capable. Quoting from Morasso. The deferential tone aside, Morasso's strategy is Marinetti's. In the passage just cited, he emphasizes the continuities between the ancient and modern eras of speed, because the objects of comparison are standing still. Their velocity remains potential. The minute the automobile takes off and the velocity becomes actual, the symmetry is sundered. It matters not whether popular fantasy imagines the chariot of Phoebus with its fiery steeds galloping across the sky, the divine messenger Mercury's flights across the ether, sudden raptures atop fiery, lightning-quick clouds, dragons, steeds with wings, etc., etc. He goes on with this long list of popular imaginings of extreme speed, of divine speed. Today's reality far exceeds even the wildest of these imaginings. The beautiful and majestic metallic fury enshrouded in a cloud of dust, driven by the hands of men at such a delirious pace that it is as if one has fallen off into an abyss. Now, the quotation is from Estetica della Velocità, one of several seminal essays and widely recognized essays published in Marzocco in 1902 that later finds its way into La Nuova Arma. Morasso's automobile weapon replays the myths of antiquity as a living, breathing reality, now within the grasp of ordinary mortals. It possesses practical value, the automobile, that is, easing the flow of persons, commodities, and information, promoting industrial development and the advancement of science. But these practical benefits are of secondary significance. Of primary significance is the car's implantation of something akin to the supernatural within the secularized fold of everyday life. The defining vehicle of modern times is thus not the Ford Model T, but instead the excessive, useless, and explosive race car, a vehicle pure in character because designed for the pursuit of speed for speed's sake. And I quote here from Morasso's Sensazioni di Velocità. Nor can I articulate that strange and unusual oscillation of my insight as though it were placed in some unknown boundary between reason and madness, between the possible and the impossible, between the real and the miraculous, between the human sphere and the superhuman sphere. Just as each of us feel when we witness the shooting of a rifle or a cannon at the moment of the explosion, that is, the inextricably mixed burst of impressions from the shock of the boom to the dismay of at the flash, the stupor that always induces in us a sudden manifestation of an unknown phenomenon, the burst of a dangerous device, to the mental impulse with which we accompany the projectile to its destination. Instead of lasting a moment, it seems that our consciousness could not handle such tension any longer. It persists and gradually intensifies, vibrating our emotions for the duration of the performance with the highest capacity of bursting energy. The sensation described is what contemporary psychophysiologists called thrill. It vibrates the nervous system beyond its natural limits, yielding an unstable surge that induces a mix of pleasure and dread, hyperconsciousness and unconsciousness, a state associated in the clinical literature not just with motorsports, but also with the modern mechanized battlefield and the ingestion of modern stimulants from caffeine to cocaine to amphetamines. Morasso actually adds opium and morphine to this list. For critics of modernity, the inevitable consequence of thrill-seeking, or as it was sometimes referred to, velocimania, was either loss of bodily integrity through accident or nervous exhaustion, like neurasthenia, or other stress-related pathologies. For apologists like Morasso and Marinetti, the effect is metamorphic. A new race of gods is born. Little does it matter whether the transformation is literal or figurative, permanent or momentary, or indeed, as is always the case within futurism, both. Futurism systematically confuses weak transcendence with strong transcendence in order to provoke a quickening of the world. Post-World War II interpreters of futurism have long felt a sense of discomfort, if not embarrassment, with the metaphysical bombast of Marinetti's language, from Démon de la Vitesse, from 1904, to the opening of Amon Pégase with its invocation of an automobile god, to the repeated prophecies of an overcoming of human mortality, as in the one found in the 1915 Multiplied Man Manifesto, which promises, and I quote, the imminent and inevitable identification of man with motor, the smoothing and perfecting of an incessant exchange of instincts, rhythms, intuitions, and metallic discipline, all of which will soon give birth to a new non-human and mechanical being built for ubiquitous speed. This is just one example of many such examples in the first decade of futurist texts. They have rightly pointed to the many ways in which, coupled with futurism's antagonism towards analytical reason, its embrace of war for war's sake, its vitalism, nationalism, and heroic individualism, such assertions of transcendental myth contributed to the movement's inexorable drift into the fascist fold. Others, somewhat less accurately in my view, have viewed such talk as proof that a conventional religiosity undergirds the Marinettian project from the start, citing as proof later flirtations with Christianity like the Manifesto dell'Arte Sacra and the posthumous Aeropoema di Gesù. Neither view is entirely off the mark, but as the introductory framing of this talk implied, neither fully captures the distinctiveness of futurism's contribution to the anthropology of speed, a contribution that anticipates a range of subsequent phenomena that obviously I won't be able to speak about today, from surrealism's quest for profane illuminations to projects like Bataille's Economy of Excess in La Part Maudite. And I'd be happy to talk about these projections, if you like, of the endeavor that I'm speaking about in conversation. So let me recapitulate. In the course of the first of the coaching revolution and then of its motorized continuation, the notion that the intensified sensorium and thrilling effects produced by speed, produced by rapid motion, fell within the domain of religious experience, was well on its way to becoming a commonplace. Speed-induced mystical transports, frenzies, states of inspiration, psychosis, or hallucination abound in everything from the sporting literature of the 18th century to Ralph Waldo Emerson's journals, to Gérald de Nerval's Odelette, to Gabriele D'Annunzio's Alcione. Some, like the American evangelical preachers of the second half of the 19th century, tried to place these new limit experiences within the fold of Christian charismatic practice, for which they were mocked by positivists like Charles Binet-Sanglé, who dismiss Christianity itself on the grounds that Christ suffered from wandering mania in his La Folie de Jésus, wandering mania being an ailment associated with hypermobility, in other words, a typically modern ailment. But even as late as Morasso, velosimania had never been elaborated into a comprehensive counter-theology that couples mental to somatic speed in the name of a new fast-paced anti-contemplative model of intelligence, relocates the supernatural in the everyday, and dialogues critically with both the classical and the Christian traditions in doing so. Who before Marinetti had observed that pace was fundamental to even the most ancient of theologies? This, I believe, is a defining back-end feature of the futurist enterprise that dovetails closely with the more familiar front-end features, like the development of an aesthetic practice founded on experimentalism, shock, and surprise, the privileging of theoretical anticipation over the inner evolution of artistic practice as a strategy for accelerating cultural change, and so forth. Marinetti's 1916 manifesto represents a key moment in this regard. It was published in the inaugural issue of the newspaper Italia Futurista at the end of Italy's first year of involvement in the Great War, when Futurism's founder was on furlough from the Lombard battalion of cyclist and motorist volunteers in which he was serving with Russolo, Boccioni, and Santelia. Its publication preceded the deaths of the latter two and marks a moment of feverish political and theatrical activity that included patriotic speech-making, performances of declamations and sintesi, publication of the manifesto on the art of dynamic and synoptic declamation, and release of the anthology Il Teatro Futurista Sintetico, not to mention the completion of Vita Futurista, the first film, and the publication of the first Futurist Manifesto on cinematography. This overall setting is worthy of mention because it helps to account for the text's volatile mix of serious theorizing, comic posturing, lyrical excursies, and sharp-edged polemics, not to mention the recurring allusions to war. It opens by recalling the founding manifesto's declarations regarding speed and modern beauty, only then to proclaim that the new religion morality of speed has been born in the course of the present futurist year thanks to our great liberating war. It concludes with a summons issued to fellow citizens that reprises prior promises of the overcoming of mortality through the metallization of the flesh in a nationalist key. Italians, be quick, and you will be strong, optimistic, invincible, immortal. In between, there are references to how battlefields, machine guns, rifles, cannons, and projectiles are all divine, to patriotism as the vectorial velocity of a nation, and war as a necessary testbed for the army, the nation's main propulsive force, and to the militarized revolution of gears, revolution understood in the double sense of rotation and political revolution. But what prevails is not bellicose swagger, but what is one of the most sustained Nietzschean arguments to be found anywhere in the Marinettian corpus, peppered with echoes of Beyond Good and Evil, and to a somewhat lesser degree of the genealogy of morals, although both sets of references are often filtered through Morasso, D'Annunzio, and especially through Bergson. The main line of attack may indeed be Nietzschean, but its content is only so in part. Due to apologies for slowness, like the one found in Schopenhauer as educator. When the philosopher of the modern era thinks of the haste and hurry now universal, Nietzsche writes, or thinks of the increasing velocity of life, of the cessation of all contemplativeness and simplicity, he almost thinks that what he is seeing are the symptoms of a total extermination and uprooting of culture. The waters of religion are ebbing away and leaving behind swamps or stagnant pools. The nations are again drawing away from one another in the most hostile fashions and long to tear one another to pieces. Within the stagnant pools of the present, left in the wake of the death of God, there are certain forces there, tremendous forces, but savage, primal, and wholly merciless, Nietzsche continues. One gazes upon them with a fearful expectation, as though gazing into the cauldron of a witch's kitchen. At any moment, sparks and flashes may herald dreadful apparitions. For Marinetti, The total extermination and uprooting of culture promises an overcoming of the contemplative cognitive models espoused by the German philosopher. He has no doubt as to the salvific potential of modernity's savage forces, or regarding the identification of the witch's cauldron with the natural magic of industrial engineering. The apparitions are the train, the automobile, the airplane, and what they promise is a rebuilding of society around a core that is best described as techno-primitive. Speed, having as its essence the intuitive synthesis of all forces in movement, is inherently pure. Slowness, having as its essence the rational analysis of all forms of exhaustion at rest, is inherently unclean. After having destroyed age-old good and age-old evil, we create a new good, speed, and a new evil, slowness. Speed equals synthesis of all forms of courage and action, aggressive and warlike. Slowness equals analysis of all forms of stagnant prudence, passive and pacifistic. Speed equals scorn of obstacles, desire for the new and unexplored, modernity, hygiene. Slowness equals stasis, ecstasy, motionless worship of obstacles, nostalgia for the already seen, idealization of exhaustion and rest, pessimism regarding the unexplored, rancid romanticism of the wild wandering poet and the long-haired, bespectacled, filthy philosopher. Futurism casts aside the philosopher's dream of a rooted, enduring culture in the name of a culture of progress, accelerated to the point of excess and expenditure, whose supreme expression is to be found in war and sport. The culture in question presupposes a form of mobile intelligence that philosophies of mind, from Plato to Descartes, either deny or ignore, and that Nietzsche anticipates but ultimately shuns. A mode of real-time, on-the-fly deliberation so accelerated that it can only be described as cutaneous, there being no time for the relaying of impulses from brain to body or body to brain, and there being an infinitesimally small gap between thinking and acting. Our life must always be an engendering speed, Marinetti adds later in the manifesto. Thinking speed plus body speed plus speed of the platform that carries the body, but plus speed of the element, water or air, that supports that platform. Free the mind from the mental roadway so as to place it on the material roadway, unquote. The futurist ideal is a racing mind wedded to a racing body, aroused by the cognitive and physical threats posed by the landscape that it traverses in order to produce and to sustain thrill. And the thrill, as the passage that I read suggested, is the mobile modern substitute for the limit experiences allowed for by traditional religious practice. Thrill is hygienic because associated with the primacy of physical culture over study and contemplation. It's pure because it is purgative, pushing the subject beyond his or her cognitive limits so as to close down all operations of recollection and expose consciousness to the pure flux of present experience. And there you can recognize the obvious Bergsonian resonances. Now, as in Nietzsche's genealogy, the point of departure is a critique of Christian morality prosecuted in the name of a futurist counterproposal. Christian morality promoted the development of man's inner life. Today, it has lost its reason for being because it has been emptied of the divine. Christian morality protected human physiology from the dangers of excessive sensuality. It tempered instincts and promoted balance. Futurist morality will protect humanity against the decay caused by slowness, memory, analysis, repose, and routine. Multiplied 100-fold, human energy will overcome time and space. As the second phrase suggests, it is history that has emptied Christian morality of the divinity that once animated its core, even more so than Christianity's faulty understanding of the sacred. The danger posed by excessive sensuality to human physiology and the decay induced by slowness and repose are for Marinetti transhistorical facts, whose present symptomatology includes the triumph of positivism in the sciences and of decadentism on the cultural scene. Because Christian morality cannot provide an adequate response to either, a new kind of divinity and a new faith are required. The first assumes the form of speed. The second, the form not of an otherworldly monotheism, not of a religion, but of a this-worldly animism, a kind of molecular animism, akin to the forms of belief examined in a wide range of works in the period, but of course including most notably Durkheim's 1912 study of the elementary forms of religious life. Here, Marinetti's choice of the phrase religione morale appears as strategic as it is unusual. I'm aware of only one influential usage, and it occurs in contemporary debates regarding the future of religion between positivist philosophers, Catholic modernists, and Catholic integralists. That work is Giovanni Cesca's 1902 La religione morale dell'umanità, and following the precedent, quote, of the great atheistic religion moralities, unquote, it demonstrates how, based upon human ideals alone, one can found a religion that shares the essential characteristics with traditional faiths, but in harmony with the doctrines of scientific philosophy. Such a human-centered religion morality, Cesca adds, is needed by our century to combat growing immorality, to counter political and social decline and forms of physical degeneration, as well as to resolve social tensions. Atheological in character, a rationalist alternative to traditional religious dogmas, it is adaptive, dynamic, and action-oriented. But in performing these roles, it also narrows the scope of the sacred, the scope and presence of the sacred within the modern world. Now, futurism, of course, roundly rejects Cesca's interpretation of the new religion morality, but in the name of a dynamic religion morality of its own, anchored in modern technics, but committed to an integral resacralization of the world. Following his opening anti-Christian salvo, Marinetti sketches out an anthropology that attributes primacy to conflict, locates humankind inside the world of nature and animals, and establishes a fluid line of demarcation between animals, machines, and natural forces. It assumes the shape of a mobility-centered tale whose evolutionary phases are man's hatred of, quote, the regular cadenced rhythm of the rivers mirrored in the rhythm of his gait, his love of the rhythm of torrents fast as a galloping horse, his taming of horses, elephants, and camels to establish humanity's godlike authority by means of an increase in its pace, his theft of electricity, fuels, and metals from nature, and last, but of course not least, his forging of a mechanical army of slaves, and I quote, hostile and dangerous, but tame enough to transport him swiftly across the curvature of the earth, unquote. The same principles of competition and coercive cooperation shape every one of the manifesto's landscapes. The world that surrounds the railway or the roadway hurls itself at the speeding vehicle as the latter hurtles forward. The cosmos is made up of stars that are at once projectiles and gunners engaged in a perpetual clash. Every iteration of speed gives rise to rival iterations. Even the sleepy Danube, under a muddy robe, self-absorbed and brimming over with fat, lusty, fecund fish, is roused from its slumber in order to compete with the speed of roadways. Threatened by barking automobiles that surpass it at top speed, it dreams of revenge. I look forward to the not-so-distant day when the Danube will course in a straight line at 300 kilometers per hour, writes Marinetti. Now here, that's presumably faster than the fastest speeding car. Here as elsewhere, the familiar 19th century tale of perpetual scientific progress is reworked into the story of how technics have granted modern individuals powers once reserved exclusively for the gods. Among the telling passages in this regard is the broader claim that inspires the comical dream of the 300 kilometer per hour Danube, namely that speed, quote, finally endows human life with one of the characteristics of divinity, the straight line. The observation is accurate from the standpoint of the history of religions. Never are the charioteer gods of Greco-Roman religion, the genies and jinns of Arabian folklore, the flying apsarases and bozatsus of Hindu or Buddhist mythology, or Judeo-Christian angels subject to the earth's tortuous path. The power of flight emancipates every celestial messenger from lazy rivers and uneven mountains. The merger between the gods' frictionless celestial pathways with the friction-filled roadways, railways, and flight paths of the sublunar world is confirmed by the transfer of another sacred symbol from the denizens of the skies into mortal hands, the spinning wheel. And I quote, "If prayer means communicating with the divine, racing at high speeds is a prayer, holiness of wheels and rails. We must kneel on the railway tracks to pray to divine velocity, which we must kneel before the whirling speed of a gyroscopic compass." So writes Marinetti in one of the manifesto's most evocative passages. The pneumatic tires, locomotive wheels, steering wheels, and gyroscopic compasses worshipped by the catechumens of the new religion, morality of speed, are new. But these products of industrial engineering arrive in the wake of tens of centuries of prayer and meditation wheels. The rose windows of medieval cathedrals, sun temples that roll on stone wheels, and prophetic visions of spinning ofanim, the fiery wheels of Ezekiel's Merkabah, and angelic and cosmological wheelings of every kind. The connection between modern and ancient wheels hinges upon the longstanding association of fast-moving bodies with global instant messaging systems. But there's an observational component as well. The phenomenon that transfixed most early observers of the mechanical age and inspired Marinetti to have the technical manifesto of futurist literature dictated by a propeller. The motion blur produced by the rapidly spinning wheels and propellers with the resulting counter-rotational movements and illusory halo. The aureole produced by a spinning wheel or propeller is, of course, momentary. After the trip, the drive, or the flight is complete, the object returns to its initial state of repose. It recovers its materiality. It again becomes earthbound and slow. Or has it returned purified and purged of the new evil that is slowness? And if so, does it then infuse the rest of the object world with the glow of its past and future velocities? And if so, is velocity now animating a fast molecular pulse, invisible to all but the devotees of the new religion morality of speed? These questions bring my reflections full circle unto the conclusion, for they apply no less to the whirring wheels, and propellers than they do to the men and women behind the wheel, quote, whose ideal shaft traverses the earth, hurled at speed along the course of the earth's orbit, unquote. The drivers seated behind the terrestrial steering wheel, the beings to whom the new religion morality of speed tenders its transformative promises. The promises in question, as I've already suggested, provide an unambiguously affirmative answer, but it's an answer framed so as to blur the boundaries between weak and strong transcendence. Deification combines with momentary highs, friction with frictionlessness, the supratemporal with the intensely temporal, in what amounts to a wholesale destabilization of the categories of both the sacred and the profane. The uncertainty is productive inasmuch as it impedes the reader from separating out the manifesto's argumentative claims from its comic posturing, its assertions that the futurist reconstruction of the universe has already occurred, and its ever more pressing calls to arms. On the one hand, Marinetti's first experience of flight with the aviator Bielovucic is recounted in order to demonstrate how, much like the car crash of the Founding Manifesto, the blood-tingling massage of the raging wind experienced in flight transforms him into a permanent aviator who flies as he walks. "You descend from the plane," he writes, "with an ultra-elastic spring to your step. Disemburdened, you have defeated the slow muck of the street. You have overcome the law that condemns man to crawl." The halo is still there, the sense of buoyancy permanent. Yet the manifesto concludes with hints that the thrill may soon be gone. "I am a man who often eats at train stations, between one express train and the other. My gaze shuttles back and forth between the wall clock and the steaming dish. The screw anxiety memory is driven into the heart. It needs to be fed with speed. One needs to believe in the solidity resistance that results from speed, the power and the complexity of thought, the sophistication of desires and appetites, the inadequacy of the earth's surface, the hunger for honey, spices, meat, and exotic fruit. All this is dictated by the futurist religion morality of speed. A metallization of the human flesh may be underway. We may all already be living in the absolute. The birth of a non-human and mechanical being built for ubiquitous speed may be imminent, but the body is still a body. It needs to sleep. It needs to be fed. Fatigue and hunger, and within them, the ghostly presence of other forms of lack, anxiety, melancholy, boredom, and the like, all continue to lurk menacingly around every corner, which explains the summons to belief. One needs to believe, even if every battle has already been won. Thank you.